But if I say I will not mention his word.
But if I say
I will not mention his word.
But if I say I will not mention his word.
Or speak any more in his name.
Or speak any more
in his name.
His word is in my heart like a fire.
His word is in my heart like a fire.
A fire shut up in my bones.
I am weary of holding it in.
I am weary of holding it in. Indeed.
Indeed.
Indeed. I cannot.
I cannot.
I cannot.
Indeed. I cannot.
That video is awesome, isn't it? During the first few weeks of the series, I've been asked, is that a real fire? So many times. The answer is yes, that was a real fire, and yes, it was truly massive. The reason it looks fake in some of the shots is due to how professionally it was filmed. It's what I imagine being on the set of a movie feels like. Which actually reminds me, do you remember the movie theater? You know, that place you could go, sit in comfy seats, eat overpriced and overwhelmingly good popcorn. You and your friends could go enjoy the latest offering from Disney Pixar or the 17th installment of Mission Impossible that still somehow stars Tom Cruise. If you plan out your cinema excursion just right, you could snag the row of seats just behind the handicap row, complete with the metal handrails where you could prop your feet up. For the next 2 to 3 hours, you could sit back, relax, and immerse yourself in the rich and fictitious worlds of Frozen's Arendelle, Peter Pan's Neverland, Star Wars' Tatooine, or, if the movie you're watching has Ben Affleck in it, Boston. It makes you feel warm and fuzzy with nostalgia, doesn't it? I really do miss the movies, though. My friends and I could spend hours talking about our favorite ones, from the plot and the action to the music and the cinematography. I'd love it all. However, the particular thing I love most about movies is a great cliffhanger. If the goal of a movie is for me to be invested in it, then a gripping cliffhanger will get me every time. And this, for me, has never been more evident than in Avengers: Infinity War. 20 full-length films, most of which are fantastic in their own right, culminated into a truly startling and shocking cliffhanger. Just before the credits rolled, we all got to watch the mighty Avengers lose the fight for the universe and half of all life vanish in an instant. For me, cliffhangers are great because of the mystery and intrigue they impart on the viewer. It's thrilling to watch the end of a movie or TV show and develop theories about what's going to happen next. Of course, that only applies to the movies, doesn't it? It's only thrilling to be in the mystery of a cliffhanger because we know that eventually it'll all get sorted out the way it ought to. We know that part two of the Avengers movie was on the way. We knew that the crushing defeat of the Avengers wasn't permanent. However, when it comes to real life and you and I are in the middle of the story, cliffhangers aren't quite as thrilling, are they? Sometimes, or dare I say frequently, we're at the mercy of the unknown, unsure how our particular story ends. There's a lot of that going around these days, as we're all painfully aware, so the natural question becomes, what do we do? Where do I find hope? When Brian approached me about speaking today, he gave me this pitch. If you could only teach one thing about our faith, what would it be? The topic that was off limits was the gospel of Jesus because, well, of course, we'd all teach that. It's comparable being asked what your favorite ice cream flavor is. Chocolate peanut butter. Thought we all just agreed on that. It's like being asked what's better, cats or dogs. Is that a question? It's dogs. The gospel of Jesus was off the table because it's the obvious choice. With that qualifier in place, I knew right away what I would be talking about. God is worthy of our devotion because of who he is, not just what he's done. God is worthy of our devotion because of who he is, not just what he's done. Our faith and trust in God must not be based simply on his works, but his nature. When we get to the place where allegiance to God is grounded in his character and his exploits, no struggle, hardship, or mystery will pull us from God, even if we don't know how the story ends. When I discovered this truth in the pages of Scripture, it changed everything for me. And my hope today is that it can do the same for you. First, I'd like to take you to the story that opened my eyes to this truth, and we can find it in the book of Daniel, chapter 3. As the book begins, it introduces us to Daniel, for whom the book is named, and three other Israelites exiled in Babylon: Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. These three men are more commonly referred to by their Babylonian names: Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Unfortunately, we don't hear much about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in Daniel's book. Naturally, the book primarily revolves around Daniel's exploits and visions. However, tucked away in this 12-chapter book is a legendary story about these three men that gets to the heart of what it means to follow God for who he is without knowing what may come. Chapter 3 tells us that King Nebuchadnezzar, who was the king of Babylon, built a colossal statue made of gold, roughly 90 feet tall by 9 feet wide. Think two semi-trucks stacked on one another. Once it was complete, the king summoned all of his leadership team together and told them, and I'm paraphrasing here, "Look, I just built a statue, and I'm ordering everyone to worship it. Whenever the music starts playing, everyone must bow down to the statue." One more fact before we really dive into the story. You see, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were Jewish men who followed the teachings of the Hebrew Bible. These teachings include the Ten Commandments, the second of which strictly forbids the worship of any gods or idols other than their God, our God. King Nebuchadnezzar's decree was in direct violation of their beliefs, and at the end of the king's new edict, it states, "Whoever does not fall in worship will immediately be thrown into a furnace of blazing fire." Despite this threat, the minds of the men remain unchanged. So when the time comes and the music begins to play, we already know that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego refuse to bow. Their brazen defiance doesn't sit well with other leaders in the kingdom, and they report this treason to King Nebuchadnezzar. Now, I know we're moving fast through this story, but hang with me. The king, as you would expect, is enraged by this, so he summons Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to an audience with him. And furious, the king addresses them, and this is where we'll pick up the text. "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you refuse to serve my gods or to worship the gold statue I have set up? I will give you one more chance to bow down and worship the statue I have made when you hear the sound of the musical instruments. But if you refuse, you will be thrown immediately into the blazing furnace, and then what God will be able to rescue you from my power?" This moment right here would be the cliffhanger if Hollywood decided to produce a movie based on this story. The accusation against these men, combined with the threat of death, is seriously intense. If you or I put ourselves in their shoes, I imagine that we would think long and hard about our next words. I'm confident that I would. The Bible doesn't give us the privilege of knowing their thoughts, though. Instead, as it does with most other stories of this nature, it reads as if their words came without hesitation, despite the circumstance. "O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God whom we serve is able to save us. He will rescue us from your power, your majesty. But even if he doesn't, we want to make it clear to you, your majesty, that we will never serve your gods or worship the gold statue you have set up." Did you catch it? Did you see it? Let's look at it again. "The God whom we serve is able to save us. He will rescue us from your power, your majesty. But even if he doesn't, we want to make it clear to you, your majesty, that we will never serve your gods or worship the gold statue you have set up." Right here is what I need all of us to see. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego do what most faithful followers of God do in the first half of their response. They acknowledge that God can do anything. They say the God whom we serve is able to save us. That's the effortless part for them. You see, they grew up hearing the stories of Moses, Joshua, David, and others every single day. They've all but memorized the tales of how God parted the Red Sea or how he tore down Jericho's walls without a single sword being drawn. These legendary narratives are a part of who they are. So trusting that God can do anything, we can assume, wasn't that difficult for them. Maybe you're the same way. Maybe you grew up on these same stories, and trusting that God can do anything isn't the hard part. However, these three men continue with their response and express a tremendous amount of truth about our faith in God and how it should look far beyond the four words they use to say it. Even if he doesn't. At least in part, these four words summarize what usually makes or breaks a person's faith in God. If you're a follower of God, let me ask you a question. Why do you follow God? People ask me this question regularly, and my answer is usually the same. God has done miraculous things in the lives of students around me that no one else could do. God provided money for my family when I was sure there was none left. God saved me from my porn addiction. The list, it goes on. A few weeks ago, I asked our senior pastor, Brian Hughes, the same question, and I asked him to post it on his Facebook, and the responses that came back were familiar. He answers my prayers and protects my family. He rescued me from myself. I follow God because I've seen him working in my life. The majority of people respond similarly. I follow God because he did blank. Our answers are usually tied to what God has done. And these answers are fantastic, by the way. We ought to celebrate what God has done and give him credit for those things. If you and I are honest, though, God's actions often become the sole focal point of our faith. Our devotion to him gets wrapped up exclusively in what he does. And this one-sided brand of faith becomes problematic and dangerous when it comes face-to-face with the massive elephant in the room. The elephant that lingers in every moment of uncertainty and mystery. The elephant inside the mind of every God-fearing person in the hospital waiting room, on the unemployment website, or simply watching the news. What if God doesn't act? What if God doesn't provide the money I need? What if God doesn't alter this diagnosis? What if God doesn't show up? To acknowledge these questions are, at best, an admission that we don't know what the future holds. Although they could point to an incomplete faith, one that is conditional. And it makes sense, right? I mean, every single relationship we have is built on this condition. Your friends are only your friends because of the things you've done for one another. Angie talked about this beautifully 2 weeks ago. If you care for someone, you show up. Our closest friends are simply the people who have been there for us when we've needed someone the most. If they quit showing up in your times of need, you can bet that your relationship will deteriorate. The same is true for your spouse. Even within the promise of marriage, if you or your spouse quits actively doing what they can to keep the relationship healthy, the bond will erode. And the only relationship I can think of that even gets close to losing the "what we've done for each other" condition is a parent to a child. Parents especially hold out the most hope that their children will someday get back on track, despite what they have done or not done. And even that relationship has its limits. Some of us, including me, have seen our relationship with God the same way. If he's moving and working in my life, we're all good. But as soon as he stops responding, or we don't see him moving, then our faith begins to deteriorate. Think about the words of the songs we just sang a moment ago. You turn graves into gardens. You take bones and turn them into armies. You make seas into highways. Even the lyrics of our worship songs almost exclusively lean in that direction. And again, taking inventory of all the incredible things God has done is not a bad thing. We need to do that daily, but to make that our sole focus leaves us with only half of the equation. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego didn't simply have half of the equation. Instead of basing 100% of their faith on whether or not God intervened, they had a different formula. Even if he doesn't. How did they get to this place? How could they say this so confidently that day? When faced with certain, brutal death and uncertain of the outcome, these men still knew God was the only one worthy of their complete devotion. Why? They followed God not only because of what he can do, but who he is. They followed God not only because of what he can do, but who he is. And that's the secret to their contentment. That's the formula for their assurance. That's the other side of the coin. See, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego knew long before that God did anything for them and their ancestors, he was. Before God ever parted the Red Sea so the Israelites could cross on dry land, God is the one who created the sea. Before God told the sun to stand still in the sky so Joshua could have victory in battle, God was the one who formed the sun out of nothing and taught it how to shine. Before God delivered Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego from the fiery furnace that day, they survived, by the way, in case you were wondering. God imagined the very idea of fire and brought it into being. See, God's just not some other guy. It's not just somebody you hang out with. God is the all-powerful, benevolent ruler of the entire universe. God is the creator and sustainer of all life. God is the orchestrator of seasons. God is the embodiment of righteousness and goodness. God can hold every single thing that's ever been created in the palm of his hand. God is the ultimate victor and hero of this story. He is the beginning. He is the end. He is love in its purest, most complete form. And long before God showed up for you in your most desperate time of need, God was the one who knew you'd be in trouble since the dawn of time itself. God is not merely the only one who can orchestrate miracles on your behalf, but also the one to whom miracles are commonplace. And guess what? None of that has changed. None of that has changed. Not to oversimplify it, but our nation and our world are in a strange place. I don't need to tell you that. Everything feels like it's turned on its head. And honestly, if there were a way in 2019 to know what 2020 would bring, and somehow we all had the choice to skip it, I bet my life savings that all of us are taking that deal. Yes, in the middle of uncertainty like this, some people might find it easy to turn their backs on God if all they measured him by was what they think he should be doing right now. But that's not how this relationship works. That's not how the relationship between God and man works. You and I don't get to decide how God moves and acts in his world. Those decisions are much too important for you and I to make, and y'all better count your blessings that I don't get to make them, because we'd all be in trouble. God says as much to a guy named Job when Job finds himself in the middle of a dire set of circumstances to which almost none of us can relate. You see, Job, who tragically lost his family, possessions, and health, cries out to God in the middle of it and says, "Why have you made me your target? Why have I become a burden to you? For now I shall lie in the earth. You will seek me, but I shall not be." You've been there? Job is essentially saying, "God, what in the world are you doing? How could you allow this to happen to me? I've been faithful to you. I've loved you my entire life. But now I've lost everything, and you don't seem to care. I'm not sure this relationship can continue this way." And you can blame him for saying that, right? But when God responds to Job, he doesn't respond with, "You know what? You're right. That's on me, Job. I should have done more. I should have prevented you from losing all that. I should have stepped in. I should have intervened." No. Instead, God says, "Who is this who questions my wisdom with such ignorant words? Brace yourself like a man, because I have some questions for you, and you must answer them. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth, Job? Tell me if you know so much. Who determined its dimensions and stretched out the surveying line? What supports its foundations and who laid its cornerstone as the morning stars sang together and all the angels shouted for joy? God does not respond with regret for not stepping in. Instead, he says to Job, who do you think you are? Do you realize who you're speaking to? You have no idea what you're talking about. And God doesn't stop there either. God continues to remind Job of how eternal, perpetual, and everlasting he is. It's a persistent, unrelenting lesson given to Job for four straight chapters, reminding Job that Job is not in charge. God is. God has always been, and he will always be. God is not only worthy of our devotion because of what he has done, he is also deserving because of who he is. And do you know what the best part about all this is? God, whose list of untouchable, unimaginable, unobtainable attributes could fill every sheet of paper that exists today, has you at the top of his priority list. It's the truth. You and I are in the number one spot. And more often than we ever perceive or give him credit for, he is using that infinite list of divine qualities to provide for you, to bless you, and to sustain you. But even if he didn't do any of that, he would still be worthy. And look, I realize for some of you, the idea of living your life for God, no matter if he moves in your situation or not, can be hard to hear and even harder to live. You see, every one of us carries around some level of pain or hurt, but some of us have been through things that the rest of us can't imagine. But today, you and I have the opportunity to dive into a deeper faith, a trust in God that isn't conditional, not based exclusively on his action or inaction. A faith that understands that we don't have all the answers. We don't always know how the story will end, and that it's okay to acknowledge that, even when it's the hardest thing we've ever had to do. We can rest in the God who knows every infinite detail about who we are and has a plan for us, a plan to prosper us and not to harm us, to give us hope and a future. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had this kind of faith. But this kind of faith isn't just locked in the pages of Scripture. It's not just some unobtainable standard that we can only hope to achieve. No. This kind of faith is alive and well today, too, right here in our backyard. Vanya Gross has been a friend of mine for many years now. We've been on student mission trips together, both locally and internationally. We attended Powhatan High School together, and she graduated just a year after me in 2010. As we transitioned into adulthood, Vanya, myself, and our contemporaries sought our careers, our dreams, our romances, and our futures. Most of us have seen those things come to fruition. I'm literally living inside of mine right now. Vanya was well on her way there too, until her life took an unexpected turn.
My name is Vanya. I'm 28 years old. I am married to my high school sweetheart, Scott. Been with him for 10 years. We have two beautiful little boys, Colton, who is 3, and Austin, who is 1.5. I've always had really bad migraines. So when I was 16, we went to get an MRI, and they found they called it a glioma in my brain. I just had MRIs, I think it was like every 3 months, and then every 6 months, and then every year. So the last MRI that I had with them, He said he couldn't see it anymore. So it was just kind of a thing that popped up and was watched, and then it just went away. In November of 2019, my friend drove me to the emergency room because I had really bad headaches with blurry vision on the left side. He said, so the lesion in your brain is a brain tumor. And he said it's a stage 4 glioblastoma. It's cancerous. I didn't even know what to say. It's like, okay. Because of where my tumor is, it's in my brainstem, they cannot operate, they can't take it out. I mean, he told me 6 months or less. That was his best guess. And he walked out. And Scott looked at me and he started crying. So we're 28 years old and we just got married. It's so weird, like your thoughts don't go to yourself. Or at least for me, they didn't. I didn't even think about what that meant for me. I was thinking about them three. Like, my guys, what are they gonna do? Best friend Amanda, she drove from Maryland to come see me, and she showed me If Not He Is Still Good on a little picture that I had sent to her previously when she was going through a hard time, and then she sent it back to me, and I had forgotten all about it. It just struck such a chord in my heart, and I'm like, oh my gosh, that's what I need to cling to, that we can't just love God and praise God when things are going great. We have to trust Him and love Him even when things aren't going the way we think they should go. I got the verse tattooed on my arm, and If Not, He Is Still Good, so that I can always look down and remind myself. I can't put that expectation on Him to heal me. I can't love Him just because He heals me. Yes, God performs miracles. I know that. I have seen that. But at the same time, to not be upset if that's not the outcome that comes out of this whole situation. So I don't see it as something that was in vain, because it taught me to really trust Him. How hard the days get, no matter how just over it I feel, that He is still in control when I feel like my world is out of control. The struggles of this has brought me closer to God. I am a different person now than I was last year, in a good way.
I'm a different person now than I was, in a good way. When she said that during the interview, I was in awe. After it was over, I asked her to elaborate on those words. How can you say that, considering what you're going through? She responded, "My faith and trust in God is deeper than it ever has been, because now I depend completely on Him. I know that He is able to heal me, but even if He doesn't, I also know He is still good. No matter what impossible circumstance or uncertainty you're going through right now, you can get there too. You can get there too. I don't know if you caught it, but Vanya's made it past her 6-month timeline. And so Maybe her miracle is happening right before our eyes and we don't know it. But that's just it. We don't know it. The end of Vanya's story is still uncertain. And no one knows where it might lead. And every day, Vanya wrestles with the fact that any week could be her last. She and her family have every reason to ask God to provide a miracle and heal her disease. But Vanya has resolved that even if God doesn't heal her, she will still follow. And you can do that. Maybe you're here now and you're ready to say, even if. If that's you, we want to help you get there. Starting tomorrow, you can go online to our website to watch a follow-up video that I've recorded on this subject that will help guide you toward a next step. On top of that, we'll be recording and posting more follow-ups throughout the week to give you practical steps to take toward being able to say, even if he doesn't, I will still follow. And as a reminder for you today, you don't have to wait till tomorrow. Today, we have these stickers for you. They say, even if. Take one. It's free to you. Take one with you. Take a couple with you and put them somewhere where you'll see them every day. And whenever you see it, may you be comforted. May you be reminded that even in the uncertainty, God is still God. And may you have the strength to say, even if he doesn't, I will still follow. Amen.